Today is Thursday, November 3rd, 2022. This is part 9 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N-M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
I'm just fine. Thanks, Tom.
Great. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Alan, I wanted to go back a little bit. You had mentioned, I think in an earlier interview or maybe in a sidebar discussion you and I were having, that you had spent some time with Ansel Adams, the photographer taking large format photos of Yosemite. Can you speak to your time with Ansel?
I can. Not a lot of time, but he had a major, major effect on me and my direction and why I was doing what I was doing. And to go back, when I was in school at Stanford, one of my friends was Dan Jones, D-A-N Jones, and he had I don't know, friends of friends or whatever, but he was kind of dabbling in large format photography as a hobby. You know, he went on to become an astrophysicist, but this was just a hobby. And he saw my pictures and interest in the hiking and Sierra Club, and I really encouraged me and all but drug me down the path to large format photography on how exciting it was and how I could probably, you know, really enjoy it and do well by it. And he actually found a guy somewhere up on the peninsula north of Palo Alto, Stanford, that had a view camera frame for sale. And we went up there and I bought it. I'm sure it wasn't more than $10 or $20 back then.
What kind of camera was this?
Well, this was an 8x10 view camera.
Okay.
And it, you know, it was wood, cherry wood, beautiful. I refinished it and stained it. It was glorious, still is.
So this is your 8x10 that you would use. You've talked about hiking in
yeah.
a Diamond Creek okay, all right, that camera. Okay.
This is where I got that camera, and I read up on it a little on what to do, how to use it, and took some pictures around home and found out, you know, how to process them. Well, I'll go back a little more. In high school, I had taken a class in photography, so I knew how to use a darkroom.
Okay.
And developed negatives and printed them. That I had been doing for years. So that's probably why Dan Jones picked on me to say, really push it. But we, you know, took a couple trips when I think I bought a new bellows for it because the old leather bellows was cracked and would let in light if you bent it the wrong way, which didn't work.
Yeah.
And you could still get order bellows from catalogs for an 8x10 camera because they were used in portrait photography a lot.
Okay.
That was the main source of those old cameras.
Hmm.
And I eventually got a decent all-around lens for it. And that the lens was probably 10 times as much value, 10 times more than the camera. But I had a tripod and bought the minimal kit, as you could say, with the large film holders. Each holder held two sheets of film. And there was a camera store in Palo Alto that very readily would order anything I wanted from, the 8x10 film had to be been ordered special, but they gladly did it, and all the chemicals and set things up. And at home in Los Altos, in the garage, I eventually built a little dark room there, so I could experiment with the printing and developing and all of that. And the books that it's actually a set of probably four books that I used the most was Ansel Adams. I don't know. I remember what the set was called, the Zone System, I guess. But he had, over the years, developed a system for approaching a scene in nature and how to photograph that the way you wanted to. I think there were four books, something about the equipment. Then there was the negative, and a book on processing, and a book on printing. And these books were like a little bigger than 5x8, but and thin. They were hardcover.
Okay.
But this really became my Bible. I just really understood what he was saying and how it worked. And he went into great detail on, why he recommended things, why it worked, what was going on.
Cool.
And the I can talk about the process a little later, but I went out on a couple of trips in my old Ford, and I took some very, successful enough pictures that I was very enthused. I had a lot to learn, but if I could see that this is something that I could do, that it would work. And I took pictures mainly around the San Francisco Peninsula, over on the Pacific side in the redwoods and out on the beach, and more landscape photography, not in town or commercial or anything.
Okay.
But then Dan Jones says, well, you're really working on that, and it seems to be quite successful for you. He was enthused, and he says, I'm going to call Ansel Adams and see if we can show him our pictures.
Oh, cool.
And he did. He was the kind that did. I was kind of appalled. I mean, I was and am a very personal, not imposing myself on others, and shy, if anything. But he called and set up an appointment, because Ansel Adams was home in Carmel.
Huh.
And he Dan described what he said. Yeah, come down. And he gave us a time, and we drove down there and showed up at his house. And the thing about Adams, if you ask, you'll probably ask me, what was he like? Well, he was one of the most friendly. For one thing, he listened. He wanted to know about, mainly about me, because Dan was, the con was he was showing, you know, wanted Adams to see what I was doing, and if there was, well, the implication was, you know, is this good enough to keep all this work? And he was very, you know, we went into the living room where he accepted visitors, and it had a it was a modern house, true mid-century modern, and it big windows looking out onto the forest. He didn't have a view out of the ocean. It was back enough that, you know, it was a big forested scene that was beautiful and very comfortable, but in the redwoods, cold and wet. And yeah, I remember a fire in the fireplace and sitting on the sofa there. And he asked, you know, about what I was doing and how. And when he found out that I was, you know, trying my hardest to use his zone system, he called it, he really perked up and looked at the pictures, and he was very supportive, encouraged, and, you know, in depth. He didn't just say, oh, these are cool, go do what you want to do. It was, he looked at them, he would ask me, you know, what about this area, the picture over here, the shade that was just a black spot. And I said, well, I'm trying to figure out how to make some details come out in that area, and how to, all the things that he talked about in his print, I was trying to do, and, you know, getting closer and closer. And he was very receptive, very positive. He actually took us in to see the dark room.
Cool.
His dark room, which was great. And he had a little kind of, there was a room next, kind of off the living room that you went through to get to the dark room. And I know those pictures on the walls there, a couple of his and a couple of the people that he was sponsoring. And I know at the time he was very into Edwin Lamb and his Polaroid system.
Ah.
And Adams ended up really working with and for the Edwin Lamb and the Polaroid for large format system of having ability to make instant negatives. And Adams was trying everything out for the Polaroid, and there were pictures there, and there was a young lady who I had heard of who was doing fine art photography with the Lamb system. And the difference, you got one picture, it was 4x5, but they were mounted in that gallery, and I was happy to see them, and, you know, literally right there, but I wasn't ready to, you know, to go from 8x10 to a instant picture was more than I could appreciate, I guess is the word. But that whole thing is another story. But Adams was very supportive. He liked what I was doing. And later, in that summer, and this was in 60, and three, '62 to '63, before I went to the Army.
Okay.
And I had, I'm trying to think, yeah, I had gone out on my first trip to Arizona and New Mexico doing the South Rim things and had a bunch of 8x10s. And Adams had said, well, come to the workshop because that, I think you'd get a lot out of that. And so every summer he had one or maybe later years, two or three week-long workshops in Yosemite.
Okay.
And where there'd be about 10 photographers, and anyone was welcome from 35 millimeter to lots of 4x5s, and occasionally, I think I was the only one with a 8x10 there, but I went up, I, you know, registered and earned the money to pay for it. It wasn't that expensive, but I did have to really plan to invest in that. And so in the summer, went up to Yosemite, and it was a very, very valuable week for me. Great contact, you know, all day and every evening with activities where he would lecture a little because, you know, people didn't want the lecturer to hear him lecture. They wanted to see him take pictures. And I thought it was, well, it was very tacky. There were some, during the day he'd have a different outing that would go on to just photograph. And some of them we had to use the, I had to have had a 4x5 because we used the Polaroid materials because the participants had to show there what they had taken that day. And the only way to do that was to have this instant photography. But I, whenever he would set up his camera, and he didn't have an 8x10 very much at that time, it was more a 5x7 or a 4x5, but a view camera where he could teach from and explain what was going on. As soon as he'd take down his camera and move away, three or four people would immediately move their cameras into that place, and if they were lucky, all but put their tripods in the same hole, but to take the picture that he had just taken. And I thought that was pretty tacky, but I just didn't do it, and I didn't say anything, but there was a whole range of people there.
Alan, were they doing that so that they could compare their photo with his and get him to critique them about their f-stop settings or their speed settings or whatever?
Somewhat. I don't recall them sharing those that much, but because he knew the ones that were taking his picture, but I, from a negative view, well, it was just kind of a trophy. Here, I took this picture.
I see.
Ansel Adams did that. But the ones that did that, he would, you know, politely, he was very patient, very polite, and people that, some of the group didn't have a clue what was going on, and I and maybe three or four others were really attempting to use his zone system, and everybody got equal, but he was definitely talking to me when he talked to me. It wasn't a general thing and discussing it, you know, in greater lengths, but not, no one could have said, well, he gave you a lot of attention, but he did.
Can you kind of, for the layman that doesn't have a, you know, that doesn't understand this stuff, can you very briefly explain the zone, Ansel Adams' zone concept?
Yes, gladly, because that's the one thing I can say from this whole thing. I definitely understood it and tried to use it and was pretty successful. The philosophy that was so different was that you're out in the nature somewhere, or a building or something out there, and you say, well, this is a neat scene, or this is a neat building, or a neat wagon wheel, or some neat rocks or something. But he was trying to get us to not try to recreate that. You've got to preconceive the print. You've got to have a very strong image in your mind as to what the eventual ultimate print is going to look like. You're looking at a 3D colorful scene of very low contrast or high contrast, and you've got to have a clear idea of what your ultimate print is going to look like, because that most of his prints don't look like, you know, if you were standing next to his camera, you wouldn't see that. They're very, very different, and it involves manipulating the images as an artist, you know, puts paint on canvas. They can be standing there outdoors and paint a scene, but they can paint something that doesn't look, you can see where it came from, but this great picture is a unique work of art, because the painter, you know, he did it personally, and the photographer has to do the same thing.
Right.
There has to be a lot of the photographer in the final print. And why you can see all the major Adams pictures, you can tell, well, that's an Ansel Adams picture. And I like to say that I look at his pictures and say, boy, that's amazing what he did there to produce that work of art. I look at modern photography and I say, boy, that's a neat place I'd like to go. You know, they've just taken a good picture. He was producing art.
Oh, wow.
Had a system for it. And it involved every step of the way. And when I look back now, you asked once what was different back then. Well, it was really amazing, because, and I can just describe when I would put up the 8x10 camera, like down in Kanab Canyon or something, I would see a neat thing, a neat scene, a neat composition, and then I'd force myself to, in my mind, to think about the black and white picture that I'm going to make. I have to have absolute black things, and I have to have absolute white things, areas of the picture to use. I mean, he just said, you have to do that. You have to think from that point of view, because and he had 10 zones then, one was absolute black and 10 was absolute white, and you'd have 8 shades of gray in between. And each area you had to decide, you know, what zone did you want. In other words, when you were standing there, before you even put up my camera, I'd have to decide, how am I going to, what's my picture going to look like?
Huh.
What's my print going to look like? How am I going to express this? You know, I'm not taking a documentary picture where I want to show what this is. I wanted to, you know, do, and it was called art, which is kind of pretentious, but getting, that's what it needed. So he recommended a specific light meter that I bought, and that was very expensive, and it was from Switzerland, and it was battery operated, and it had a little telescope, and you'd look through the telescope, and you could, in your scene, look at a, well, there's a tree, which the shadow, that shadow I want black. And I would look through there, and there was a scale that I could turn the knob, and the little arrow would go up and down. And when it was on center, right on the center of the scale, it gave me a number which I could write down. And I'd say, well, that's the number for every black area that, and then I'd move to the white. And it wasn't always white. If you're in a canyon deep area, there's, it's just gray when you're looking at it.
Right.
But it want, that has to be, the highlight has to be white on your picture, or it's going to be really a, I would say, dumb picture, but without the highlight being on zone 10. So I'd move over there, and it's, you can think of a modern light meter that you hold in your hand, you push the button, it gives you a number, and that's what you expose. This thing was very specific, because I would end up with at least 4 or 5 readings for the scene. It just, it had this little telescope so you could isolate, you know, way of, a ways from you on what was the value of that, you know, the how bright was it. And you'd write it down, and that was the easy part, because then he had the whole, well, on taking the negative first, you had to know which film would be appropriate.
Oh, wow.
Because if this was a low contrast scene, you needed a high contrast film that would, you know, broaden the contrast. And if it was a high contrast scene with highlights and deep shadows, you wanted something that was going to bring the values together. And by his recommendation, I used a kind of a general 8x10 film that was not extremely high contrast or low contrast. It was kind of in the middle.
Okay.
And then it was knowing how to expose the negative to make sure that the dark areas that I wanted to be black with just a hint of texture in it, because just a black blob, you know, there are some of Adam's pictures that are very effective with the huge black area, but if you look carefully, the real print, you can see detail in those black areas.
Okay.
And that's right at the boundary where you want to speak for. It's hard to do. And then with, you know, I would put the film holder in the camera, and then getting good depth of field, you use a small f-stop, and the thing people are surprised is that the exposures could easily be quite long, several seconds. It's a dark area, even, you know, 20, 30 seconds. And you just can't. I had this bulb that you squeeze that tripped, that opened the lens and held it there as long as I held on to it. And I'd count in my head, you know, 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, and then let go of it and the lens would close. The exposures were quite long. It left out, you really couldn't do anything with the wind blowing, because if you had plants or trees in the foreground, that didn't work.
Right.
It'd all be fuzzy, as you see in some of the old, you know, explorers' pictures. Same with running water. You had to be very careful as to how that was displayed. You could get pictures of running water, but you had to work at it and know that if you didn't, it was going to be just a blurry mess.
Right.
And the camera had to be held perfectly still with, you know, and I'd stand to the side and had a strong, a heavy tripod, because the camera couldn't move at all, or the whole negative would be down. But so that's the first step. And then I'd take the negative home several days later, or I described how there were, I actually had a little darkroom tent, but going home, the next issue was developing the negative, because there's a lot that the photographer has control over the negative. You can have, basically, it's the different developers, the liquid developers. Some will increase the contrast.
Oh, wow.
Because if you think of the negative, your black areas are almost clear and was barely exposed, and in the end is going to have just a tiny bit of silver. The highlights you want well exposed, with, and it's going to have a massive silver left there. And there were different developers that did it differently, and they were superficially called, you know, low contrast, high contrast. That's just whether you want to, from Adam's point of view, spread the contrast out, make it greater, or make it less. And so each negative was, you know, potentially developed in a different tray of developer. I think I had three developers that I used normally, and I'd mix them up in a big bottle in the dark room at home. And I obviously, if I came back and had 10 negatives, I'd divide them into this group needs that developer, and I'd do all of them together. But they were developed one at a time and washed to get all the chemicals off the negative, and then it was hung up to dry on a clothesline in the greenhouse. And I and then there's the print, which the photographer had control, because you could buy low contrast paper, high contrast paper, normal. And if you really did your thing and you were Ansel Adams and had 20 years experience, you just used the normal best paper, smallest grain, and I had a contact printing frame, which was a wooden, like a picture frame with a sheet of glass, and you'd lay the negative down with the emulsions that on the glass up, and you'd lay a piece of photo paper on top of it, an 8x10 piece of paper. Then there was a wooden thing that just sat down and squished them together flat, and it had a little twisty lever that would hold it in that position. And then I had a light on just a regular incandescent light bulb, a pretty low, maybe if you could get 20, 30, 40 watt light bulb. And you had to measure the light bulb and set it up above the print, the paper and the negative, because you were figuring out the best exposure for this print, and you had to have the light be constant or you'd never know what really worked if you had different setups. So you would take, these prints, it would be anywhere from 20 to 40 seconds of exposure to make a print. And the first print, I'd put a piece of cardboard over and I'd be counting down, and every 10 seconds I would slide it another 2 inches over, count another, and slide it again and again. So when I developed this test print, I had really 5 or 6 different exposures at the same, just doing it in one session. So there were strips across this print of different exposures, and it was obvious, and you never quite knew just which one was going to be the best for that day and that setup and temperature and everything. But you'd pick the one that was right, and you'd, of course, you had to print the picture first and decide which one was going to give the best exposure.
Wow.
And then you'd go back and put another piece of photo paper in there, expose it exactly, there was a thing that's called dodging, and it's kind of complicated, but you, in a way, you gave the very edge of the picture couple seconds more than the center of the picture. And Adams had figured out that it's mounting the picture on a white board. If you want a little bit that no one can see that difference, but it affects the view of the picture, but that's irrelevant. But then if you develop the print, wash it, I set it out. I had a rack like a drying well that you dry vegetables on, with a whole bunch of trays, and you just stack your prints in there and they dry. If you have a commercial thing, you can have a heated big roller that turns by itself, and you stick the print in one end and it comes out the other end smooth and nice and dry. But you can just hang, just lay them out where they're flat. They aren't pressed down at all. When you do, they are completely dry. A couple days later, you can actually put an iron on the back and iron them all and get them flat.
Huh.
So, you know, the... I'll mention that, well, that trip with Adams, you know, it confirmed that everything I was doing was right, that I needed to focus on it carefully, I needed to experiment carefully. I would take volumes of notes on every picture. You have
okay.
to. He had to, because he'd, you know, he would describe the whole process before he took the picture. You know, this is going to take this negative, this film, this processing, that paper, that processing, and he'd keep a note of it. And for me, I had to keep a lot more because I was still learning exposure and all of that. So it was quite a big deal. And I, you know, when I say I took a picture on one day out in the canyon, it was, you know, there was a lot to it.
Yeah.
And if you go back to the original photographers in the 1860s and 70s and 80s, and I always look back on the ones that went down with John Wesley Powell.
Right.
And I for the life of me, I can't remember. There were two of them, their names. But they had the additional challenge of using glass plate negatives.
Right.
Well, glass plates. And they, to take a picture, they had to set up a darkroom tent before they set up the camera. They had the sheet of paper of glass. They mixed up the chemicals to make the emulsion that was light sensitive. They would pour it on the negative, and that was kind of like a squeegee that you spread it out across the negative, and some were more and less successful at just that. And then you would put it in the film holder that made it light, you know, protected it from the light, go out and expose your picture on the camera. While it was still wet emulsion, you'd immediately go back in the darkroom tent and develop it right then.
Oh, wow.
And all those early photographs were developed that way. They just... Even the Colt brothers' earliest ones, I think, were, I'm not positive that they had wet plate, but that was very, very common. All your Civil War pictures, the photographer was there with the darkroom tent. And then... it was one of the great motivators when I read that Powell's second expedition, the group left the river at Kanab Canyon, and Jacob Hamlin, who was an explorer, Mormon explorer from Utah, and an outdoorsman and packer, he met the group at the Colorado River, the photographer had to load this pack of glass plates, of sheets of glass, and load them on the mule, and the mule carried them out the canyon.
Right, without breaking them.
Without breaking them. And, you know, there's no doubt to me why they were few successful pictures. And I just really related to that no matter how complicated it was to me, there were several layers that those guys would have just in their dreams couldn't imagine that I was had a sheet of film that could just sit in a box for a month and then
right be ready to go with. Yeah,
right. And the other thing that I thought of to tie my trips and everything together, the last time I talked about doing a major project for Zion on replacing the pictures in the museum.
Right.
And as usual, it wasn't my habit, but it turned out I wasn't a con man at all, but I certainly ended up with I jumped at the opportunity that would come along, because when I was at Pipe Springs and I was doing a lot of photography work, I had to wait until absolute dark at night, because I would lay all my chemicals out on the kitchen sink board. I washed the negatives in the sink and the paper prints and all. And fortunately, it was all dark there. I just turned out all the lights. I may have put a sheet over the window just in case, because if someone walked up with a flashlight or something, it would have been disaster. But the thing at Zion, they had just finished the new visitor center, and attached to that was the park headquarters with everybody.
Right.
All maybe 20 people that worked there. It was very small in those days with staff. That building still exists. And I think in the museum part, there's a climbing museum now or something like that of the original gear and all of that. But anyway, that building had been part of the Mission 66 of upgrading park facilities.
Right.
So it was probably built in the early 60s, 60 to 2, 3. I was there in the later 60s. But the thing that struck me is the interpreter, Lewis, who ended up hiring me to take the pictures, said, "You got to come see our dark room."
Oh.
And down in the basement of the building was a very excellent little dark room.
Wow.
With all it needed was a lot of counter space and sink to wash things in, and boxes there that were light safes, they called them, where you could store unexposed film and paper. And he said, "This is a really nice thing." He said, "I used it a couple times a year ago, but nobody uses this." And I said, "Well, what do you say if would you mind if I came over on my time off and I could develop film and print with my own material, my own chemicals, my own paper, everything? I would just be using the room."
Hmm.
And he said, "That would be great, because someone needs to use this thing.
Cool.
Maybe you can show us how to do it."
Oh, wow.
So when I talk about going over there every, my days off for, it was at least 6 weeks, I definitely had every evening, or after I was, it was every evening, late afternoon or evening, when I'd done my photography in the park for that project, which I was being paid for, I would then do my own work in the dark room there. And I also was readily, rooted around seeing if anybody had anything they needed developed or printed, because I would do it.
Oh, cool.
And they came up with a couple things, the rangers and headquarters, and I was glad to print, and they were happy. They were overjoyed, because rather than sending a negative off to Denver or Washington, they could have somebody do it right there.
Right.
So it was a win-win for everybody, and a lot easier, and that's where I got most of my my photography, the black and white, the 4x5s. I processed there very happily.
So, Alan, this I'm going to jump into a rabbit hole here, and go to today, where we have digital cameras that can take thousands of photographs, you know, as fast as you can push the button, it'll take a picture. And then we have Photoshop and other familiar or similar programs that can manipulate these electronic images. What are your thoughts about today's cameras and electronic manipulations compared to what you were doing here in the 60s?
Yeah, that's been a major issue with me and a concern. But I'll be honest to say that I welcomed it with open arms. I mean, my first Photoshop program that I put on my computer was back in the 90s.
Okay.
Because right now I very proudly, there's a rare day that I don't use Photoshop today with my old pictures and new pictures. And
oh wow!
I very proudly use Photoshop 7. And that was, I was kind of peeved at Adobe when they stopped supporting Photoshop 07 about 20 years ago.
Hmm.
And basically said, buy a new one or you're on your own.
Right.
And I just said, well, mine works for me, and it still works for me. That picture of the horses in the Esplanade.
Yes.
Yeah, that was photoshopped.
Okay.
You know, because that and all I do with it is, like, that's a good example. It was very flat, grayish-like picture, and I just expand the contrast a little and didn't change the picture in any way. It just made it, it looked 10 times better.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
On it. So, you know, and there's several of my older slides, and I've got a really good Nikon slide scanner, and I use the Photoshop to, some of them are just completely washed out where you can barely see an image, and I can restore that very effectively. So I'd have to say that I can't complain about it too much since I use it constantly. I have to admit that one of my granddaughters was taking a photo class in high school, maybe 6 years ago, but I gave her my last 35 millimeter, and I've been using my iPhone ever since. Which, you know, iPhone plus very judicious use of Photoshop, and I'm quite happy.
Okay.
But I use it, I'm taking scenic pictures like calendar pictures. I'm not doing anything that I would consider fine art.
Okay.
And where, if you ask me, where is the calendar picture and the fine art, where is that line? I would say, I don't know. It's just in the beholder, and it's in the photographer's mind somewhere.
Right.
But that's, and, you know, I've one person that we both know that she won't mind me saying, but Gary Ladd, you know, he took 4x5 pictures for years.
Right.
Commercially, and beautiful pictures, and sold the prints and made illustrated book after book after book. And he has thousands of color negatives and mainly positive slides. And right now, you know, he's still kind of working, but that whole archive is basically worthless to him. And that just hurt me. I took that personally. Also, you know, I feel for him so strongly. And he now takes his pictures digitally. And I don't know if he uses Photoshop. He probably does. I wouldn't be surprised. It's just a very valuable tool.
Yeah.
You just can't get silly with it and increasing the saturation of the color till it's neon bright, you know.
Right.
And I definitely don't take, edit things out of pictures or put things in that weren't there.
Right.
That's, you know, a fun and games, but it doesn't belong in serious pictures where I'd like people to know that what they're seeing is what was there.
Right.
And, but Gary, you know, has now digitized. He digitized a lot of his positive sheet negative or sheet film slides or whatever. But he hasn't been too pleased with it. He does continually take pictures, and I think he's made the transition to the digital very well. He's definitely carrying a lot less camera gear around.
Right. Right.
When we went down the river with him on the last trip of his boat, the Donahatsu, he still had his 4x5, and he would go out and spend, you know, an hour or hour and a half taking one picture. So, you know, that was the good old days.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I...
Well, it's just interesting that, you know, there was a time when glass was the way it worked, and then glass went to the negative, the paper negative. I'm not sure if paper is the right term to use
well,
there.
No, it was this, what was it? Silicose. And that problem was even worse because all the first negatives that were not glass, they were very flammable.
On nitrate, yes, that's right, on nitrate film.
Yeah, very flammable. And even negatives today and positives are flammable, but not, the original ones were explosive. So
right. And
a lot of the photography we lost that way.
And then going from what you're talking about, what you were doing in the darkroom at Zion, and now what you're doing with your iPhone, people that take up photography today will start with an iPhone and Photoshop, and they won't know even about the darkroom and how it works, and you know, because they're thinking about how to capture the photograph they're after today with the tools that they have.
Right, right. A lot of them would be very... The younger people would be surprised if you went in to a photographer to have your portrait taken. He would go through all the things and take the pictures, and then he'd set up an appointment to come back the next day or in 3 or 4 days when he got the pictures processed.
Right.
There was nothing instant
right.
about it.
That's right. Yeah, our wedding pictures were taken that way.
Yeah.
You know, you get the pictures and you come back a week later and see what they got and choose what you want.
Right.
And yeah, very yeah. different. Very different time. Yeah. So it's a different tool.
Right.
The question is, does it still produce the same high quality artwork, as you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it sounds like you've made the transition fairly well, so that's good.
Yeah, and I always, well, you know, in not too many years, I had a, you know, to come to a decision, and I eventually, the family and being at home, and I took precedence and kind of sadly put the whole photography thing aside and finished a degree in elementary education and taught school for 20 years. And really, you know, I always thought, well, I could set up something where I can, well, print some pictures now and then. Well, it never happened.
Hmm.
So now all of my, not all, but quite some of my original 8x10s, I've digitized and they're now stored on my computer.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I can make good prints of them
because
mm-hmm. I, mm-hmm. All that. So I, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I think it's kind of scary as well as we go to the digital world, because now we're talking about electrons, and yeah, the nitrate film can catch fire. You know, the negatives of today
yeah.
and positives can burn up, flood, susceptible to water and weather and whatever. But boy,
right.
you know, if you don't have the proper electronics, the proper app to deal with the electronic file, it doesn't work either.
Yeah. Right.
So the whole right. thing is tenuous at best.
Yeah.
It
and
seems.
I honestly say if you ask me, the current storage archiving thing, that's more tenuous than a pack of prints, and I've still got in my file drawer right next to me here, there's probably 58 by 10 negatives just sitting there, you know.
Hmm.
And they've been there for 50 years at least.
And they still work. That's the thing about it. You can still take those out and they still work. But you know, do you still have a floppy disk reader? You know, the sort of storage we were, you know, do you have a zip disk reader? You know,
that's the issue. And I faced that very strongly, 5 years ago now, when my wife Sharon's parents passed away, and they live west of Las Vegas, and Sharon and her two sisters had to go and, you know, deal with the whole house. It was organized and neat, but they had, well, color slides, a whole closet full of slide carousels.
Hmm.
And there were several thousand color slides. They had drawers full of black and white and color prints
wow.
of family and travels and
yep.
It was given to me to do something with it. And I ended up digitized about 1,000 prints, you know, color slides, prints, and they're on the computer. And I've actually printed out really nice contact prints, they're called, but they're like four prints to a page,
mm-hmm.
And I can make a binder for all the her sisters and their children.
Right.
So I've made 7 sets, but my big issue is what format, you know, because when I started, it was hard discs, and now it's the thumb drives.
Right.
And to me, thumb drives I see as very precarious because I feel like, you know, just grabbing a handful and throwing them away.
Yeah.
But not even knowing what was really on there.
Exactly.
It's a nuisance. But I've got to realize that there's a whole computer worth of information on there.
You bet.
And I've also, it's important to me that I printed out copies of the whole archive for the family.
Hmm.
Each one gets one.
Right.
And my son and daughter-in-law are very tech-oriented, and in theory, we'll be able to maintain and transfer from one medium to another.
Right.
It's like now, I'm wondering, well, why isn't all of this on the cloud somewhere? Well, I'm not comfortable with that. It would be one more bit of technology to learn from scratch and evaluate all of that.
Yeah.
It's,
well, the technology keeps marching on, and
real questions.
How do we save the data?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. We've been online here on the phone a while.
Yeah.
We
should probably wrap this up.
Yeah. And we'll talk afterwards by ourselves, but that'll be good. It's a good place. I did get Ansel Adams in there. I never saw him again personally, but definitely followed everything he did.
Nice.
And where he went and I used his system all those years. I still look at a picture that way. So
nice.
That's good. So anyway.
Cool. All right. Well, with that, this would be a good place to put a comma in this interview series, as we say, and conclude part 9 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Thursday, November 3rd, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you.